Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as Two Champs and a Chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast. Hey all, welcome back to the White Book Podcast, / Props and Slops. This is episode 497.
Who are you slashing?
Slashing, I don't know, 80s teenagers, probably?
What? Oh, well, then they won't be current old people.
Well, I suppose. I mean, it could be like a retro thing.
Like a retro encounter.
Oh,
I like that podcast. I don't think it exists anymore.
Oh, well, that's a bummer.
Comes back. It would be nice if it came back. Hi, I'm Aaron. Sorry. I'm definitely in a different world for a second.
I have no idea what those conversations were about.
You've listened to Retro Encounter, right?
I have listened to Retro Encounter, but I'm confused by the specific discussion that you two were just having. But
I mean, then so are our listeners. Awesome. Good start.
Hey, you chose that. That's not me.
I mean, that's pretty par for the course with the way we treat our listeners, right?
Listener.
Ooh, yeah. I haven't heard in a while that
Sam David just listened to it because he wants to hear your lovely voice, Aaron.
No, Sam doesn't like me.
Oh,
wait, I'm confused. So we said that Sam was the only listener, but then I was like, David also listens.
Oh, David. I love David. David also listens. You're correct. David is a king. I forgot that David listens. David does listen just because he likes us.
I want to hear your wonderful sonorous
voice. My dulcet
voice.
Tones. I'm sure that actually means something, but like, I don't know.
The English teacher,
yeah.
Doesn't super matter.
As I was reminded again yet again today, I am not an English teacher.
As most words, it definitely means something.
I am an English teacher.
You are an English teacher.
That's what I teach. It's definitely the subject I teach. Ooh, that was convenient.
Well, we are so unfocused right now. I got so used to Aaron's like, bam, let's get it moving.
I may be waiting to die in a video game.
I was going to say, and he's over here playing Vampire Survivor instead of keeping
brushing us.
So,
you want to start there?
Yeah, you know, that would be a change of pace. Let's do the stuff we've played first this time.
All right. Go ahead, Aaron. Tell us all about Vampire Survivor.
Vampire Survivor is a $3 game on Steam, which is just about what it feels like it's worth. It's a little like pixel art. I'm going to have to put it down right now. I don't think I'm capable of dying. It's a little pixel art, like almost like Castlevania 1, from a top-down perspective. You start out with one character, but you unlock others very, very quickly. You think I have 7 or 8 and there's 12. And like they all have a weapon, and as you kill enemies, like it auto fires from that top down perspective. There's like books that surround you. There's a little magic missile type thing. There's a whip. There's the like cross from Castlevania, and they all have different like attack motions. And like as you kill certain enemies, they drop little blue orbs. Those orbs help you level up. Every level up, you get like 4 different items to choose from. You choose new weapons or new armor or support items or whatever, and eventually you can combine them into evolved weapons, and it is super fun, and it is $3 freaking, so it's a phenomenal deal. I strongly urge people to play it if they don't like their free time. Also, I was getting really, really bad Tetris with either effect or syndrome, depending on how you phrase it, from it, but I turned off the auto flash because there's like a flash whenever you hit an opponent, and It seems like that was what was causing it. As soon as I turned it off, it went away.
Huh. Okay.
But yeah, that. Am I just going to keep going for video games?
I guess so. I don't know that I have a lot to add other than, you know, I looked it up on Steam after you mentioned that. And I'm seeing here both recent reviews and all reviews are listed as overwhelmingly positive on Steam.
It's a ridiculously good deal for I've put like 10 hours into it, and it's a ridiculously good deal for $3.
Cool.
You should try it. I think Will will love it, and I think Roy would love hate it.
Yeah. Well, I look for $3, I'm buying it right now, I think.
Nice. After you recommended it, I was like, no.
Yeah, well, because you're like, I won't boot up my computer when I have time to kill. Although now...
It's just the gameplay did not look interesting to me. I watched like a trailer, I watched somebody stream it for a little while, and I was like, So.
Oh gosh, I have to talk about Diablo now. Whew, what to say about Diablo Immortal? Other than I broke down and played it. I like having some kind of mobile game. I like I've been a Diablo junkie since the first Diablo. I've never been big on the whole competitive PvP aspect in literally any game, let alone Diablo. I just love the, you know, dopamine hit of, you know, mowing through mobs and seeing what your new randomly generated loot is. So I was excited to try that out on mobile. I'm not one of those people that super, you know, decried the announcement of Diablo Immortal. So I gave it a try along with three of my high school buddies that we used to, you know, get together and LAN party the original Diablo 2, which feels weird to say original Diablo 2 since it's not the first.
Right, they did a remake, didn't they?
Like, yeah, they just did the remake. So yeah, had to specify that. But yeah, we've done a little grouping and stuff, and like, yes, there are some flaws, you know. A, is the game kind of toned down or dumbed down in order to, you know, be mobile touchscreen friendly? Yeah, I think so. Is it much more so than Diablo 3 was? Probably not. I already thought 3 had really kind of dumbed down the controls and combat. Not that it was ever super deep to start with, but this has also really stripped down like character advancement. Everybody levels at, you know, the kind of this same rate, and all the stats go up the same for every class at the same point. There's no picking and choosing skill trees or where to invest skill points or stat points or anything like that. Yeah.
It's the most fun part of it.
There's no character advancement?
Not level based like that. I mean, yes, you do unlock additional skills as you level up, and you can only have 4 equipped at a time plus your main attack. So depending on what you, you know, assign to your buttons at any given point kind of leads to some different builds. Everything else is either basically gear or gem based to go in the gear. So,
no thanks.
Yeah, like I said, it's dumbed down for the mobile thing. I can understand why they wouldn't necessarily want people blowing all that time on the stats and stuff. You know, the cynical part says, well, if you shove all of that over into, you know, gems and things, then you can make some kind of microtransaction out of that. So. I mean, it is heavily incentivized to monetize things, but I don't think it's unplayable? Like, for somebody like me that does not care at all about PvE and keeping up with the Benjamins, then the microtransaction and like gating of features essentially does not matter.
In 2 months, we'll be living on one of our couches.
It's true. It was really nice. You know, we have a spare room here. I know it's going to be hard. You know, maybe you can make some money selling some items to somebody, Will, to get out to the East Coast. But
I'm not addicted at all. I won't get addicted to this clearly addictive thing.
Definitely not. I definitely was not addicted to the prior Diablos at all.
Ever, not once.
Yeah. But I've been having a good time with the story.
I'm sorry. Repeat. Go back, Will. What did you just say?
Well, okay.
That's how we know he's addicted.
The single player campaign. Calling it a story, I suppose, is generous.
I mean,
that's the same in all of the Diablos.
I mean, Diablo 1 was a creature of its time. Diablo 2, in the context of that of what it was, had a good story. Like, it was in that era of, like, decent Blizzard stories where Warcraft 3 came out, the original StarCraft, Diablo 2. These are all, like, good to great late 90s, early 2000s video game stories. Then Diablo 3 came out, and it has, its story is kind of morally reprehensible and really, one, honest to goodness, one of the worst single player experiences that I've ever had. Like, I literally got to the end of Diablo 3.
Hey, Final Fantasy 13.
Yeah, well, Final Fantasy 13 is literally unplayable. Like, that game is just unplayable. Diablo 3 is playable, which is why I got to the end of it, which I did not get to the end of Final Fantasy 13. And I was just like, what the fuck did I just play? Like, why did I do this? Like, why does female evil Diablo have high heels? Why is that? I don't know. But you just made me morally comfort. Like, I felt like I was, like, brought into Chris Metzen's kink, and it made me feel gross. Like, that's how I felt, like, at the end of Diablo 3. And I just cannot believe that Diablo Immortal has, like, at all an acceptable story, considering how bad Blizzard stories have gotten over the last 10 years.
I mean, like I said, calling it a story is generous. That was just shorthand for single-player campaign, right? The story is not really the point of these type of things. But I have no intention of doing PvP. I'm just working my way to the level cap, going to the next dungeon, and so on. You do hit a couple kind of sort of time gated things, like level gated, really, where like you're playing the campaign and then suddenly you're at like level 32 or something, and you can't actually enter the next zone till you hit 35, stuff like that. So I assume those gaps were kind of created to shunt people over into spending some time on like the daily bounties and the challenge rifts and stuff, and hopefully talk them into buying some of the power ups to try to maximize returns on those. That hasn't felt super necessary to me. I mean, like I said before we started recording, I did buy the $5 battle pass and like the, you know, 99-cent beginner bundle or whatever. And that's probably all I ever really need for what I want to do. I boosted some of my rewards early on. I can keep kind of up to date with my gear well enough to keep killing mobs. So, yeah, I'll play through the rest of this campaign. Probably max out my character, do some dungeon runs with my high school buddies, and call it good.
Good.
I look forward to spending more time with you.
Yeah.
Soon, oh, my friend.
And for what it's worth, I did mention the whole mobile thing. Most of my play has actually been on desktop. Having the desktop, technically beta, has been very nice to mouse and keyboard it instead of touchscreen.
Before we continue on to Aaron talking about the 50 million things that he's played on his Steam Deck, listeners, friends, stay a while and listen. It's very important, after listening to Will describe Diablo Immortal, that you contribute to the Patreon. All right? Will is about to enter a really difficult
financial time. And it's just really important if you continue for these episodes, if you've enjoyed Props and Slops and you enjoy the Thrones content when Thrones is producing, you know, there's a world championship coming up. There's nationals coming up.
How do you know that? Are you back on the...
No, I am not. I play Magic. That's what I do. All right. Anyway, you should contribute to the Whitebook/Props and Slops Patreon campaign to ensure that Will is able to keep his balance sheets in the black and not living in Aaron's couch. Because let me tell you,
you have a guest
room. So much air conditioning in Aaron's house during the summer.
Right? And do not turn off the AC.
Having stayed in Aaron's house when it is warm, it's best we keep Will, you know, in Springfield. That's what we're saying here.
Yeah. I need to stay here in my native 94 degrees Fahrenheit and, you know, like 85% humidity. Otherwise, I'm going to get the chills and it's going
to
be bad.
Don't force Will to break bad. That's all we're saying. All right. Contribute to the Patreon campaign so Will can continue his immortal trip through the world of Diablo.
Oh, I like it.
All right. I'm up.
To the Steam Deck.
All right, cool. So I played more of both Persona and Skies of Arcadia, but those I will save for later. I played Fire Emblem 6, which is Binding Blade. It's the one before the first English one. It's a fan translation. And my working thought, and I talked about this with Roy a little bit already, is it's... So I don't like permadeath, but not because it makes the games hard, but because the games are easy, largely because of the weapon triangle. As long as you can figure out what weapons beat what weapons, it's not super hard outside of critical hits. But it makes it easy but slow, and that's a very frustrating combination. Like, I can't just bum rush things and let characters die because of permadeath, but like, it's not hard to strategize and win, because like, otherwise that you would be losing people left and right. So I don't like Fire Emblem 6, like, at all.
I mean, which is perfectly reasonable. Like, I think that the earlier Fire Emblems definitely have that problem. Like, I think it's a problem in the core gameplay loops, particularly of the Fire Emblems, before they introduce the ability to not have permadeath. Mm-hmm. And so thus they need to design maps to have, like, a little bit more, like, engaging strategy beyond that. And that's, I mean, I think definitely true of the older ones. I think it's a problem that by the time, like, I think Fates starts really playing with that, but I think by the time you get to certainly Three Houses and the, what is it, Echoes of Valencia, is that the remake, that the last remake that came out on the 3DS, they've mostly solved that problem. But definitely, and a lot of what makes some of the GameCube era ones really good is sort of like the story and characters and kind of the sort of way they play around with sort of balance in the Path of Radiance era. But it has been long enough that these are only vague recollections, I think, improves a lot of the situation. But I definitely think for some of the Game Boy Advance era games, that's definitely present.
It was frustrating because I really do like tactics RPGs, right? Like, an awful lot. Yep. It was just a very frustrating way to play them.
I would skip ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna start. Very soon I'm starting Path of Radiance.
Oh, I'm excited to see what you think of it. I haven't played that game in, it's probably come up in a decade. So,
well,
still own it.
The reason I'm going to start it soon is the next game.
So, go on.
Vandal Hearts was, for a moment there, like, crazy fun. Yeah, but so I'm on this battle that I really, really hate, and I'm going to try and explain this battle. You get to a town, and there's statues that have turned all the townsfolk into, like, zombies. Does this sound familiar, Will?
Not off the top of my head. I think
so. Your job is to break all the statues and, like, use boxes to wall off the townspeople. But if you kill all the townspeople, it's game over.
Oh.
Now,
Vandal Hearts, in its infinite wisdom, has auto counterattack on every attack.
Oh.
So when the stupid townspeople attack you,
right,
you murder them.
Yeah. So, and like they all die in one hit. Like, so it's doable, but it's unnecessarily frustrating because the game isn't hard, right? Like, there's some decent strategy. It's fun. But like, it's not hard. It's just like, this is so artificial. It feels like, you know how those escort missions in a lot of games are super frustrating? It yeah. feels like that, except worse, because like
that sounds about right, yeah.
every townsperson is a green unit. And it's just like, I'm eventually, I think, because I really enjoy the game, and I'm assuming that it's not going to do this to me again. Yeah.
That's assuming a lot, my friend.
I might just look up how to like do it, like copy a step-by-step, like move-by-move guide for this one battle and then move on to it. But like, the point of tactics RPGs is I am not anti walkthrough, especially now that I don't have time to like wander in circles forever. But like, the point of strategy RPGs to me for the most part is that I don't need a walkthrough, right? Like the battle, like figuring out the battles as like a puzzle of like positioning and stuff, I think is super duper fun, but not so much when, like it's just, why would you have that setup if auto attack is a thing? Like, I don't understand in any way, shape or form what they were thinking with this decision.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, well, it's 1999, right? Like, or 1996, excuse me, when Vandal Hearts came out. So, like, quality of life, improvements in games, not forcing you to do things that are extremely tedious and call attention to the problems in the core design philosophy. These are all things game designers, particularly Japanese game designers, had not learned and would not learn until the 21st century, mid-2010s. So... yeah,
I mean, some games already, like, whenever I hear that, all I want to do is go, but Chrono Trigger existed,
right? But I mean, there's always like an innovative game that
yeah
challenges
that anomaly.
Yeah, like, and that's what later designers like look to and learn from and then implicate. But like, overwhelmingly, particularly for JRPGs, poor quality of life decisions and forcing and putting the player in situations that really accentuate the like fundamental flaws of the gameplay loop are like a huge thing for the first 20 years of JRPGs.
Yeah.
Like, I say this as someone who enjoys them. Like, I'm not like, I can talk about the problems of Western RPGs had in the era. Like, I'm just,
yeah.
It's just a thing. So,
yeah.
It's history.
I like a lot of old games, and it's just, yeah. Yeah, this feels particularly frustrating. Like, the problems with Fire Emblem are just, like, if you enjoy Fire Emblem, I can see you not, like, hating that, right? Or, like, if you're not, if you're new at strategy games, I can see, or, like, you know what I mean? I can see what they're going for. They're going for almost an artificial difficulty. I don't hate that. It's not for me.
Yeah, it's kind of a lazy difficulty, right?
Yeah, like, I'd rather they just made it hard. But, like, if you prefer it this way, like, I understand that that's taste. I can't imagine anyone enjoying this battle in Vandal Hearts. Like, because it's not anything, right? Like, it's just dumb. Ugh, whatever. Nothing for it. Okay, last thing I'm going to just say. CDKeys.com or CDKeys whatever dot something is a pretty cheap way to get some games. If you're ever interested, check it out. It's apparently a gray market, but it's not illegal. All the games are perfectly legally owned and such. So if you have interest, go check a game out. I bought like 6 games for $20. It was a pretty good deal. And then I spent another $10 even though I have the extra money right now because I found Ni No Kuni 2 is still $60 most places, and it was $10 on CD Keys, and I was like, you know what? Screw it. I'm grabbing it. So I ended up spending $30, and I got like 7 games, including Final Fantasy 13, because now I have access to every Final Fantasy. My general get every JRPG is still a thing. And Monster Train and like just a bunch of really fun games. So, especially at that price point, it was an excellent, excellent decision that I am very happy with. Check out cdkeys.com if you want to grab cheap games for basically anything, Switch, Steam, Xbox, anything.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah. Apparently the games are basically like bought wholesale, and like the companies don't super like when you do this, right? But it's still like perfectly legal.
Interesting.
So my plan is to generally avoid buying indie games on it, and like...
That makes sense. Like
a Nintendo game. Well, I bought a couple indie games.
I don't think you... Like, can you even do it with Nintendo games?
Yeah. There's Switch codes.
Well, yeah, I did. Roy, did you mean like first party Nintendo games?
Yeah, first party Nintendo games.
I don't know. Let's double check.
The Quarry. That's the next game I'm buying. Play with my wife.
Yeah, one of my students, I'm not going to say it on the air because it's very shady, taught me a way that he gets all his games for $5. I'm not going to do it because it is shadier than I'm willing to be. So I'm going to look up Astral Chain because that's a game that I'm...
Oh, I mean, let's do this. The easiest one. Fire Emblem. The next game I'm buying after the Quarry, Fire Emblem. There's no Fire Emblem on this.
It looks like there might not be a...
Let's try Mario. Mario Brothers U Deluxe.
Huh.
And Mario Kart 7 for the 3DS. You can get it for $59.29.
For the 3DS. Yeah.
So, there are very few. Breath of the Wild is -2% and $70. So apparently first party Nintendo games aren't really a thing here.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, I guess, because you can't really wholesale, right? Like Nintendo's
No. You can get the Quarry 27% off, which is actually pretty okay for the first, like the game just came out.
What game?
Did you ever play, oh my god, what's it called? Until Dark? I think that's what it's called. The Hill Dusk might be what it's called. Dusk. The PlayStation 4, I think it's a launch title for PlayStation 4. Like horror adventure game where you're like basically controlling characters in like a horror movie. Like from the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. So it's like a visual novel meets like kind of horror survival thing. Ala and I played it together. We really enjoyed playing it. They made a bunch of like smaller, lower budget versions of this, but this is their first big full budget one. And it just came out today? Might have come out Friday. It came out June 10th, so Friday.
Cool.
So I'm excited. I'll report back in the future.
Absolutely.
But I am too busy to be playing video games right now. So
almost curses. Done. Almost to video game summer, friend.
Oh yeah, the summer of magic and video games. Oh yeah, look at that.
I uninstalled Arena, but a bunch of my students who are graduating heard that I used to play Magic when they were like sophomores in high school. And so have spent several years apparently playing Magic for the time that I would play with them as I would install Magic.
Rip.
So I might have to reinstall because that's too cute for me to not, you know?
All right. So do we want to go back up to where we normally start? Talk about Obi?
Whatever makes you happy.
Well, Will, you're the founding host. What do you want to do, my friend?
Yeah. Let's continue our way down the list from where we are, and we'll loop back to watch at the end. So let's hit up listen next. What have you been listening to, Roy?
Oh, I was you were gonna talk about this, I was gonna run and get some
drink.
Okay. No, that's fine. I'll talk about Slow Burn Season 7. Okay, so Slow Burn is a Slate's history podcast. I really enjoy it. I think I talked about maybe the sixth season on here once. So it started off doing two pretty mediocre seasons on the Watergate scandal and the Clinton impeachment. But each subsequent season has been really excellent. There was one on David Duke, one on... the Tupac Shakur's murder, one on, I'm forgetting, the Rodney King trial, obviously that's the one I used in class, and the current season is on the history of Roe v. Wade and abortion rights, and it is really excellent. It is easily the best history podcast produced by journalists. It does a really good job of both doing really in-depth historical research, talking to expert historians, doing the reading, doing the research, doing getting great interviews, but also telling it in a really engaging and complex way. So if you are, we are, this summer is going to be a summer in which arguments over reproductive rights and the legacy of Roe v. Wade are just going to become extremely heated. And a lot of Americans are going to lose, most likely, their reproductive freedom. I think if you want to understand how we got here, I would highly recommend listening to it. It is, again, really, really quite excellent.
Cool.
Nice.
So.
Are you spending your nights watching the hearings?
No. I read about them, but I don't watch them now.
Okay. Yeah. Agreed.
All right. What are you listening to, Will?
I
died, so I'm back fully attention.
I am baffled here that no one told me that last year the original producers of Unsolved Mysteries, you know, the Robert Stack vehicle, have started an official podcast that to me feels much closer to the show I grew up with than the Netflix
reboot.
Even reboot feels like a generous word. Not that I haven't enjoyed that,
but lush documentaries that Netflix has acquired,
yes,
and branded with Unsolved Mysteries. Well, yes. Which is new season supposed to come out this summer.
I mean, and I will happily watch that. I love those type of documentaries. They just do not feel like Unsolved Mysteries. But the podcast, I think, really does. Of course, they have rights to use the original music and stuff. The new narrator I've gotten used to, I can't recall his name now. He's perfectly fine. It's just the instant I hear that music, my brain is primed for Robert Stack's voice. And part of me thinks, you know, surely he recorded so many seasons of that show that you could probably feed that audio into some kind of AI generator and like Frankenstein a continuation with his voice.
I don't know. When we talk about Obi-Wan Kenobi, we'll learn about AI generated voices not being really the strongest things in the world. So
yeah, that's fair. It's not always the same. But regardless, after a few episodes, I got used to this guy. He's solid. And I've really enjoyed it. It's not, each individual episode is not kind of an anthology the way the episodes of the old show were. It's more that each, say, 20 to 30 minute episode of the podcast is one single story, like one segment from the old show would be. But I've really enjoyed it. Story. I've probably listened to a dozen episodes since I found it last week. So check it out.
All right.
So now that sends us back to where we normally start.
Wait, we're not doing read? That's no one read? We all forgot.
Is there a read?
I
didn't
read,
think there was a read this week. Essence.
I felt like I read something, and I can't remember a single goddamn thing I've read.
IAs that I read? Because I can do that.
I don't want to even pretend I remember that IB exists at this exact moment. So yeah, that I guess. All right, I'm gonna peel off this Band-Aid. Obi-Wan Kenobi fucking sucks.
I feel like that's strong. Though I will admit two things. We got really busy last week through the weekend and stuff, so I've not actually watched 4 yet. But also go ahead and discuss. I literally do not care about spoilers on it.
It's so boring, slow, and repetitive. Everyone forgets their basic capabilities every 45 seconds. It's just annoying. Obi-Wan is like, Star Wars has very few cool characters, like, that they haven't in some way, shape, or form ruined. Obi-Wan was one, and they are taking their time making him a complete fucking moron in the show. Utterly incompetent. He's like, I'm going to kill 18 stormtroopers. Uh-oh, here's three. Better immediately give up. And it's just like...
Yeah, that was awkward. Because like, he was a friggin' better sharpshooter than, like, Jyn Erso or Cassian Andor. I mean, or, like
it,
literally not, anyone else we saw. Like, that was wild.
Any other show. Like, literally, in that episode, 2 seconds before that scene, he was such a good shot that someone had a gun to Leia's head.
Yes.
And he shot and killed them. And then 2 seconds later, he gives up to three stormtroopers. And it's just like
and, you know, and when has Obi-Wan ever, like, at what point have we ever seen Obi? Like, do they normally, was that something they used to do? They gave Jedi, like, intensive, you know, sharpshooting training in the temple as well? Like, I mean, where did these skills come from?
But then at the end of the episode, Darth Vader whoops his stupid ass, right? Like, just destroys him. Starts throwing him around with the Force, tries to, no, it's great, I'm fine, I don't give a shit. I'm willing to take, like, I hate that they've made him so uncool, and thus I have much less interest in the show. But Darth Vader literally is, like, whipping him around into fire, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, there's one shot that explodes something. And even though Obi-Wan is at the exact same distance, and Darth had just been using the Force to throw him around, all of a sudden he forgets he can use the Force and acts like he can't possibly get through the fire and gives up and leaves.
That is the worst scene in the show.
I'm so fucking confused. He's literally using the Force to pull him into the fire from that exact distance. There's a shot. There's a little explosion. Obi-Wan does not move, and then he just, like, fucking straight up forgets what was happening 6 seconds before. And I'm just sitting there like, you hate him, and he's like 5 feet away from you, and you have, like, you were just using the magic power that lets you, like, and I don't feel like Roy, before we started, said, like, it's who puts the air in the tires in the Batmobile. I'm like,
this specific scene.
It made my brain hurt, and I just sort of gave up on the show. And I was just like, you can't pay attention to your own, like, not scene to scene, in the same scene. You stop paying attention to what you established.
I mean,
that's such bad storytelling.
For the Vader scene, at least, and I'm going to preface this by saying it is not established well in the show, but the kind of explanation I've seen is basically that the sudden, you know, explosion or whatever kind of shook Anakin out of it for a moment. And he, you know, kind of processed that this was Obi-Wan and, you know, their bond and history together and all that sort of jazz, which would have been an interesting take, I think, you know, have one of the other Inquisitors question him about why aren't you doing something, and then for Vader to be like, you know, don't you dare question me and turn on them, you know, like, you could do stuff with it. They didn't. That could have been cool.
I've read Marvel comics for a long time, and what you just did is called a no prize. And, like, no, that was like, hey, we're publishing 1,000 comics a month and no one's looking over our shoulders, so we're just going to make shit up. No, like, fucking explain it. And if you don't explain, you're doing a poor job. And it's not like he was so shaken. Darth sits there and stares at that stupid fucking robot for like 40 seconds. The robot that carries Obi-Wan away is through the flames, the exact same 5 feet away. And he forgets to, like, does he have random warm feelings for that other robot too?
He's always had a soft spot for droids.
They
could have solved this problem by making it clear that Darth Vader is, like, letting Obi-Wan get away because he, like, likes toying with him, right? Like, I mean, that's
that could work too. Yeah,
they could have solved this 1,000 ways, but yes, you know what they didn't do? Any of them. They don't even bother. They're not trying. Like, because that scene doesn't happen if they're trying, right?
Well, the end of that scene doesn't happen. I think everything up to that point was fine.
I mean, it was just a bad fight scene. It's fine.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like,
I mean, this is something I've been talking with some friends about is, so 2 points. One, this show, I think each subsequent Star Wars show has shown the weaknesses of the technology that they use to film these Star Wars shows, which is called, what's it called?
Giving a shit?
Crud. I forget the name.
No.
The screen thing where they're projecting like the 3D models onto screens around the actors.
As
like,
they act?
While they're acting.
And it's literally like a relatively small room.
Yeah.
Like you can tell that like one of the reasons why the like Leia running in the first two episodes is like kind of weird, because you have to imagine this is a 10-year-old, or she was like 9 at the time, like running around a very small room, and them trying to make it seem like she's like running long distances. And then when she's in the city and she's like running in the like the technology is really constraining their ability to do that. You see that in like a lot of these like big scenes in like the Inquisitor base, like feel very empty, right? If they're not in like hallways or like kind of confined areas, everything feels very empty because they can only have, I mean, this was made worse by COVID protocols in the Boba Fett series, but it's also present here. They can only have so many people in any scene, right? You also see this in Doctor Strange, because Doctor Strange used this too, this technology as well, is that some scenes feel very claustrophobic and not necessarily purposefully. It's because they can only film in this like room that isn't that much bigger than like Aaron's apartment, like in the amount of space that people can move around, right? Or like it's very small comparatively. They apparently built a bigger one that they used to film the Marvels, but like the limits of the technology is like really showing in these Star Wars scenes. And then secondly, like good lightsaber fights are expensive and require a lot of work. You see this in the prequels, right? Like compare the prequel lightsaber fights to the sequel lightsaber fights. There's only one good lightsaber fight in the entire sequels, and that's in The Last Jedi. And that's nothing compared to any of the prequel lightsaber fights, right? George Lucas put a lot of money and effort and time into like making those fight scenes good. They are the best things about the prequels, except maybe the one in Attack of the Clones, which is like kind of embarrassingly bad. But the ones in Episode 1, Episode 3 are excellent. But do you think this Star Wars?
I mean, you know what's really annoying? You know
it's going to have this? Like, it's
that,
gonna
that stupid indie company that owns Star Wars never wants to put any money into it.
Or put any money that it, or Marvel. Like, they, like, a lot of the Marvel shows suffer from this as well. Like,
We've seen the original Star Wars, right? Like, we've seen Star Trek. We've seen, like, a million things that were done with 1/1,000,000th the technology we now have. Like, if you're not going to have the money, then you need to tell stories that fit the scope of what you have. Like, if they had done a really cool, smaller Obi-Wan show, that it would have been like, oh, shit, this is daring. This is so cool. Instead of this giant, sprawling disaster of a show. Because, like...
That's 100% true.
Like, it would have been, like, artsy, and everyone would be like, oh my god, I can't believe they did this. This is such a cool take on Star Wars if they had told a smaller story, right? Or, like, set it on one planet and, like, strand him there. Or, like, something. Do something, right? Like, use the sets you already have. It's not like there aren't 1 billion fucking Star Wars sets floating around. Whatever, right? Like, there's all these options.
But, they keep going back to Tatooine for freaking everything. So, well, like,
if there's
they
one
can reuse all of that.
Then it makes sense. That would be on Tatooine, it would be Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, that would be the only one that makes sense.
But he's there, and they're still like, we're going to tell bad... Like, I genuinely believe from the bottom of my heart, Star Wars is a bad franchise. Like, I just... I wasn't even going to keep watching Obi-Wan. And then Carla was like, please. And then at the end of episode 3, I was like... I skipped episode 3, right? Like, I was like, all right, I'll wait at least a couple weeks. I'm going to wait. I'll watch them before the podcast. And Carla was like, come on, let's watch. So we watched 3, and I was like, I don't want to watch this anymore. And she insists we watch 4. And then 4, I mean, why?
I think 4 was better than 3.
Yes, everything was better than 3. 3 is one of the worst episodes of Star Wars television ever. But it's still bad. Like, it's just, it's nothing. It's doing nothing. It's like captured, escape, captured, escape. Quick character moving.
I mean,
I really wish my wife didn't like Star Wars, so I could never watch this shit
again. I think there's two things there that Aaron, I think, makes a good point that I think is worth pulling out, which is I do think that this show does suffer from, like, problems of scope, right? Where I think the best moments, like, they want these big moments, right? And the best scenes in the show have not been the big moments, right? Probably the biggest moment that landed for me was like when the third sister says at the end of the second episode, I think it's the second episode, right, to Obi-Wan that like Anakin Skywalker's alive.
Yeah,
Obi-Wan Kenobi has like a panic attack. That's like a good scene. Another really good scene is the one where like that MAGA creature like sells them out to the stormtroopers in the third episode, and they like get on the truck and a friend of mine said it's like the Deliverance theme plays when that happens. And then in this episode, the small scenes between Leia and third sister are excellent. But all the times they go big for the big set pieces, the Vader versus Obi-Wan fight, the sort of ending of this of the fourth episode sequence, just all don't land. Because for them to succeed, you have to spend more money than Disney can reasonably spend on a TV show, even a TV show like Obi-Wan Kenobi, particularly when you're paying Ewan McGregor's day rate, right? Like, and like, I don't mean to shade him. Like, I'm just saying, like, he is going to ask for a solid amount of money, even with an executive producer and back-end money, right? And plus the baseline special effects that you need to make even a lower-stake Star Wars to work. Like, all of that's expensive, and then you're asking for, like, movie-quality action scenes? Like, I think all of that just really, really stresses the ability of all of these Disney Plus shows to be successful. I think the more successful ones, and you could argue, and we'll get to admit, the most successful one so far has kept the scale much smaller.
I mean, at least it didn't until it was, like, super successful, and now it does big shit, right? Like, or it limits
No, I'm not talking about Mandalorian. I'm talking about Ms. Marvel.
Oh, okay. Oh, we'll come back to that later.
Before we move to Ms. Marvel.
I wasn't trying to transition
it. Okay. So the Empire-loving farmer, whose character name I can't recall now, who do you guys think voiced that?
Wait, repeat that?
I have no idea.
The farmer that picks up
Obi-Wan, the MAGA farmer,
and Leia, and then turns them in.
Who's basically wearing a red hat that says "Make the Empire Great Again."
Yeah, yeah. Who do you think voiced that character?
George Lucas. I don't know.
No, I would have sworn up and down. In fact, I did while watching the episode that was Seth Rogen. Kristen went to look it up. It was Zach Braff. Now, why?
Zach Braff in Glazer's favorite television show?
Yes. Yeah. As in the main character from Scrubs.
He wasn't in Gilmore Girls.
Now, why they paid Zach Braff to do a Seth Rogen impression, I don't know.
I think this that kind of cameo was not that paid. Those kind of cameos are like, do you want to be in Star Wars? Yeah, I'll be in Star Wars.
Probably. That would explain why there's, you know, several comedian cameos in each of the Star Wars.
Well, one of the so like far. that guy who's an asshole that's a comedian that was on The Mandalorian, he actually got
Bill Burr.
Yeah, that guy. Like he got paid. But
yeah, I mean, and he actually, his character honestly had a solid arc. I've seen some convincing arguments that he had a better ex-stormtrooper arc than Finn did.
Well, I mean, that's not that hard. Like Finn. Hashtag, like, you know, save Finn. Like, Finn got mistreated.
That is true.
In the sequels, like, one of the greatest fake outs of all time, which is the ad campaign with Finn with the lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not, but anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't have as harsh an opinion as Glazer does, but I think that this show is fundamentally flawed. Every episode, like tomorrow I'm going to come home from work and I'm going to boot up Obi-Wan and be like, I hope this episode like solves all the problems. It probably won't, but I choose to be hopeful every time. Yeah. But Star Wars suffers from a problem that if it causes you to ask like too many questions about itself, you go, wait, why am I watching Star Wars? Right? That's to me. Like every time when a Star Wars movie is like, or a Star Wars show is like, this doesn't make any sense, then you start thinking about it and you're like, oh my God, why am I watching Star Wars? And there are I think this show and Boba Fett really have had a lot of moments like that where you're like, why am I watching Star Wars again? Why did I choose to do this to myself?
I mean, that's basically where I am for the whole franchise. Like, it is not ideal that this was immediately after Boba Fett, right? Like Mandalorian.
I do think this is better than Boba Fett, for what that's worth.
It is. I think it's overall better.
So it's better than Boba Fett, but like in terms of my expectations, it's so much worse.
That's gotcha. I mean, Ewan McGregor is just a better actor than Timothy.
Like, it's true. I'm still enjoying watching him.
Boba Fett was never going to be good, right?
Yeah. That's hard to argue with.
Like any idiot can write a good Obi-Wan story. Like, he's got, what is it at this point, 50-ish years of like goodwill built up as a character. Do you have any idea how few characters have 50 years of nothing but goodwill? Like, even if people who hated the prequels loved Obi-Wan in them, I'm one. Like, 50 years of goodwill, and they still can't tell a fucking halfway decent story? How is that possible? And like, this isn't Solo, right, where they were like, different actors, and it was clearly like a cash grab, and like, oh man, this is gonna be trouble. This was like as close as you get to an absolute goddamn loot slam dunk.
I think I'm not sure this is a specific problem with Obi-Wan, but with a multitude of the new Disney era. Is any of these times where they are trying to like work backward and fill in something where we already know the endpoint, it has not worked well. So Solo, Obi-Wan, even Boba Fett, since we already knew because of Mandalorian, where he was about to end up. Half of that show had problem.
So, no, I think you're wrong here, and I'm going to explain why really simply. Remember the new trilogy?
Yeah, the sequels.
Yeah, the sequels. Also, like, I mean, so that's counterexample number one. We didn't know. That could have ended anywhere. Well,
okay.
But wait. And thing two, remember Clone Wars, the show? Well, where we do know where it ends up, and it was still like, no.
I should have said where we know where a character ends up. I think that's
where all the characters are.
That's why Clone Wars worked better. Like, yeah, we know where like Anakin ends up, but like there's a length of time involved there that's greater than some of these that just I feel like gave more room to work with. I don't know. I'm thinking about that and self-defeating here because I'm like, well, there's a big gap with Obi-Wan. So, yeah, I don't know.
I think the problem is that they're bad at telling stories. Like, I think that's
weird. You think they could hire the absolute cream of the Hollywood crop, right?
Yeah, but like they clearly only hire people who are bad at telling stories. And like, my evidence for that is all these people that keep telling stories that are bad.
Yeah, Robert Rodriguez.
Sure.
Oof, yeah.
They're just these people, like, maybe they're brilliant and there's so much corporate, like, oversight that, like, that's destroying it. But no, I think they're just bad. Like, I just think they're bad. I think that, like, this isn't good, like, there's no plot, right? Like, it's just stuff that happens. And, like, it's relying on your being like, but I love Obi-Wan, but then it strips Obi-Wan of all the things we love about him. So, like,
I'm not sure what the real hook is. Like, I just don't get it. Let's move on. We've wasted enough time for this stupid goddamn show. Like, this is my least favorite show in the past several years. And I don't watch a lot of shows I don't like, right? Like, I'm pretty good at only watching things I really like. But, like, this is my least favorite show. This is my least favorite show since, and I know exactly the last show I've hated this much. This is Us. This is my least favorite show since This Is Us. Because I think This Is Us was manipulative without doing any of the work. It was just like,
oh, This Is Us, ended, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. But I watched, my wife watched the first two seasons while I was in the room. But like, and it was just like, we're going to do this really heavy scene. And like, it's like, did you earn that? And they're like, absolutely not. But we're going to give you like six of these scenes an episode. And you're never going to have time to stop and realize that we didn't do the payoffs. It's like, hmm. But like, that was a significantly better made show than this. It's just, that's the last show that like made me actively angry and frustrated to this.
Euphoria for millennials and Gen Xers is what This Is Us is.
All right, whatever. Let's do an amazing, fantastic show. Or at least an amazing, fantastic episode of a show.
Episode.
A marvelous show?
It was so good, right? Wasn't just me?
Fantastic. Yesterday I rewatched
it. I had a lot of fun with it. Yeah.
Like, best first episode so far, I think.
Probably the best since
WandaVision.
Yeah, I'm fine with WandaVision's first episode. I think I like this better. Like, it had a really nice visual style. It did the whole, like, Spider-Man thing super well. Like, it paid itself off. It moved at a good clip. All the characters were super likable. Yeah. Like, the mistakes everyone made were, like, relatable and understandable. Was it, like, brilliant? No. But it was fundamentally, like, hyper effective, right?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I could not watch that episode without spending the whole thing thinking about Never Have I Ever.
I felt some Never Have I Ever in there.
Yeah. I think really you just substitute out the voiceover from McEnroe for the kind of stylistic background, art stuff that they did in Ms. Marvel. And like, otherwise they were playing around with very similar stuff,
sure,
which I'm okay with because I loved Never Have I Ever.
Me too. But the Never Have I Ever main character, whose name I will not recall.
Davey.
I got it as soon as I said I won't recall it. My brain was like, yes, you do. Davey. Davey is a much more, I mean, like, even from episode one, a much more complex character, right?
Right. I think everybody is, which is something I was going to say, even like parents and siblings and stuff. But of course, Ms. Marvel, I've only had one episode so far, but I also still just don't think these Marvel shows are ones that will develop, you know, mom and dad and brother any further than we got in episode
one. Mom's going to get more development.
Maybe.
100%. Maybe. But the new origin is tied specifically to her mom.
Oh, okay. So. That's fair. She did seem to have a reaction to the bracelet.
Well, and the bracelet came from her grandma. So, like, on her maternal grandmother. So, like, definitely that side of her family's history is going to be an important part. Like, so I imagine the mom is going to be the most developed adult character. And she also gets the most screen time in this episode. So, of all the adults. So,
That makes sense.
But, I mean, I don't think a Marvel show. Like, these shows, like, one of the things I liked about this show, right, was, like, as Glazer said, all the characters likable. But I also think, like, the parents aren't treated as, like, villainous, which is always a, like, trap you can fall into in, like, teen fiction like this, rather than, like, you can kind of see where they're coming from. And I think even a teenager can see where they're coming from. Like, they're not trying to, like, set up a hard, like, Kamala versus her parents. It's sort of, like, Kamala figuring out who she is, which I think is, you know, a really good arc. And I think it's good that Disney has kind of like taken elements, I think, of like where teen fiction is right now and even their own Disney Channel formula, plus the Ms. Marvel original comics, and really combined them, I think, in a really, really good way. Like, I mean, it was just really like, I mean, there was so much like love and care that Marvel shows, have all mostly had. Like, I think, like, Moon Knight also had like a lot of love and care. It was different, but I think this is where it like all comes together. This one, I think, really
like each Marvel show to me has felt like Marvel is figuring out more and more like the best way to do their formula on television. And, you know, each of them have been better or worse depending specifically on how they implement it. But I think each one, like, figuring out the formula has gotten better overall. And I think that's all really crystallized with Ms. Marvel. Like, just like every element of it is in service of the story and formula that they want. The story they want to tell and the formula they want to use to draw you in. And there's so many nice touches. Like how they text and then on the...
It was almost, I mean, it wasn't this, but it was like Scott Pilgrim-y, right?
Oh, it was definitely clearly influenced by her, right? Like, I mean, did you see, I believe Scott Pilgrim was on the television. I think it was Scott Pilgrim. It was a...
There was something she was watching.
It was either Juno...
Wait, what was that?
It was either Juno or it was Scott Pilgrim. Because it's Michael Cera from that era. So I couldn't... I actually tried when I rewatched it. I was like, is that Scott Pilgrim? Or is that Juno? I couldn't remember. So, but it, yeah, I mean, I think it was clearly influenced by that like type of storytelling.
I mean, it was, I mean, it had a plot, right? Like it was clearly going somewhere.
AvengerCon.
It was adorable.
It was great.
I mean, I loved so many small touches, like Scott Lang going on bunches of podcasts and talking about the Avengers, it just in like general, I think it was a really funny touch that I'm excited. I hope they pick up on a little bit in Ant-Man 3. Like if like Scott's arc in Ant-Man 3 is that he's kind of become a bit of a like ass because he's super famous now. That would be a good twist, you know, cause he was, you know, that great scene with him and Hulk in Endgame. Would be really funny. So I'm excited.
Yeah, I mean, yeah,
I look forward to more. And yeah. can we just talk for a moment about how, you know, bear with me on the phrasing here, but how Big Brother's beard game is on point.
He does have a good beard. He's much nicer than the comic version of the brother too, at first.
I admit I've never gotten into the Kamala comics, but this is kind of making me want to check them out.
I mean, they're just the early Spider-Man story, right? They're really, really well done.
I think Ms. Marvel, like the first couple of issues, got stuck with the terrible crossover that she emerged out of.
Yeah.
And once it gets past that, it gets really good. But I think like the first, I didn't like the first three or four issues that much.
I liked the first issue an awful lot, and then it falls apart for like three.
And then, like, I think the first couple of years of Ms. Marvel are really quite excellent overall once you get kind of like past her origin, which I think I know a lot. There are a lot of people on the internet who are attached to her powers and her origin, but that's always been like the least important part of me, part of the character to me. So I do have some questions.
I mean, there's people that freak out about like Spider-Man shooting webs from his arms in certain iterations, right? Like,
I remember that
discussion. I mean, look, I listened to a 10th grader today while I was subbing talk about how she didn't like that none of the actors who played the parental generation in the Harry Potter movies were 35 years old. And because that's what they would be in, that's what they were in the continuity set up by J.K. Rowling. And I was just like listening to her and I was like trying to be like, are you sure that's like what you should really be caring about? And so this was, you know, so there are definitely people, even well-meaning people who are like that. So I have a couple questions. Do you think Carol will show up?
Yes. I think so.
What do you think, Aaron?
End credits.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Do you think it's going to be the end credits, or do you think it's going to be in the sixth episode or the end of the fifth?
No, end credits. It like she like lands and is like, "Come with me," or does that stupid.
But why would she want her to come with her?
Well, that'll be the season, right? Mm-hmm. Like they have to get together, and like they can do the like tease for like in Marvel in
Marvel. It's called
Marvel, right?
Yeah.
Tune in next year for the Marvels.
Yeah, I mean, it's only January, February, I think. So it's pretty quick.
March, April, May. Sorry.
So one of my friends suggested that Monica would be the one that actually shows up in like the fifth episode.
And we just get a Spectrum appearance instead.
Spectrum, and then like Carol will show up at the very end, but she'll show up not for Miss Marvel, but because Miss Marvel's with Carol or with Monica, and okay. she wants Monica. So
I could see that would be kind of a smoother connection.
I was like, I thought that's a good idea, but you know, because Monica is working for the government at least last time we saw her. So
sort of if. Yeah. If S.W.O.R.D. still exists, do we still don't know what happened to S.W.O.R.D. as a like organization after that.
There's always new organizations, right? Because this one is called NICE, which I think was taken from the comics. Right, because NICE is from that era when they were saying that all teenage superheroes were illegal, right, Aaron? Which was like
all of those like run together.
It's like late Bendis era, right?
Late what? Repeat? Sorry.
Isn't that late Bendis era, like around when Civil War II?
It sounds like, right, but like all of that shit runs together.
Yeah. So, and the federal agents from No Way Home are at the end of the episode, so.
Hey.
Damage Control.
But no, that's not Damage Control.
No, that show got canceled.
Well,
or
but,
not.
But also like
Damage Control. I don't know how I should say that.
But Damage Control weren't the people who arrested Peter, though.
Right.
They're the ones who seized all the Stark stuff, but they're not the ones who arrested Peter. There was like someone else who's that dude who was at the end of the episode. So, but anyway, I really enjoyed Ms. Marvel.
Agreed. Huge props so far.
I'm excited. Honestly, it's the thing I'm looking most forward to tomorrow. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's definitely the case.
Tomorrow, English regions. I've got a very, very, very busy tomorrow. Let's not talk about it. Dead Still.
Oh, yeah. So that was one I watched, and I realize now I meant to look something up about it before recording because it's a BBC show that I watched on Amazon. And, of course, British shows have the frustrating to the U.S. convention of calling season a series. And so I watched all of series one on Amazon. But that made it unclear, is there a series/season 2? Did I watch the entirety of the series/, I don't know. It made me realize, I realized that I literally don't know what like the BBC calls an entire run of a show. Like in the US, that is a series.
Probably just a show.
But okay, there we go. So I don't know if I watched the entire show or not, but at least series one was super, super fun. It's basically you follow a photographer who is I believe they call him a memorial photographer. So in the 1800s, there was a fad for a while of posing the deceased and taking one last like family photograph with them. Family photograph. Yeah, creepy. But so he specializes in that. And through kind of a turn of events, he winds up being kind of drawn into a mystery with a serial killer who appears to be posing the deceased for photographs as well. So yeah, it was a fun romp. I thought the first episode definitely plays it up as a horror comedy, heavy on the comedy kind of end of things. And the comedy kind of fades as the series goes on. I guess horror is a strong word, but definitely kind of drama suspense. So it gets less funny and more serious as the plot thickens, as it were. But I thought it was super, super fun. I would recommend that folks check it out.
Cool. Remember the Ice Cube movie Friday with Chris Tucker?
We're talking about the original Friday?
Yeah, I watched it.
I don't think I do.
I haven't seen that movie in like 20 years.
So maybe I hadn't seen it since we had fake pay-per-view in when I was like 15 to 17. Shit, yawning. Sorry, last day, kids. Emotionally drained. But the other day, I was waiting for Carla to come out, and I hit HBO Max. I honestly hit the button on my remote by accident, and Friday was the top recommendation. So I watched Friday, and that movie remains freaking hilarious. Genuinely excellent movie. If you haven't seen Friday, it's on HBO Max. Watch it. It's super freaking funny. And quotable.
Okay.
So, friends, have either of you seen Everything Everywhere All at Once yet?
Dang, I have not.
Right?
I said no. I don't go to the movies except to watch Marvel movies.
So it is now on Amazon Prime. If you two buy it, it is $20 on Amazon Prime. I do not have money until next Friday, but I will Venmo you each $20 for this movie. So you fucking finally see it so we can talk about it on this podcast. So if you would like a free movie, watch it by next episode and tell me when you have and send me your Venmo, and I will literally send you $20 next Friday when I get paid.
you don't need to go that far. I think that's what we're turning to our Patreon supporters for, right?
I don't care how you do it. Make it happen by next episode. Movie is phenomenal. There's things I want to say and I can't. So it's out on Amazon, Apple, etc. Pick one, YouTube TV, pick one, watch it. You have 2 weeks.
Okay.
I almost certainly will not watch it between now and the next episode.
But I will give... You are done with
it
school.
It literally does not matter the money, Aaron. I have $20. I'm in my pocket. I literally have $20 in my pocket that I could spend on this. I know myself. I will... When I am free, what I will be doing is playing the Mushu Fire Emblem game. That is what I'm going to be doing with my free time. I already know.
You're gonna just bounce off it.
No, I will get like halfway to 3/4 of the way up through it before I bounce off it. That takes at least 2 weeks. So that's exactly Strikers. So, which was literally, I think, this time last summer is when it came out. So
yeah, they seem to be doing one of these here. Oh, hey, we didn't say that when we did games. I don't know if Will knows this, but Persona 3, 4, and 5 are coming out for all modern systems.
So like Xbox?
Xbox and PS5 and PC/Steam.
Intriguing.
Makes me slightly sad that I'm playing vanilla Persona 5 on my thing, but I've also put like 40 hours into it and I'm not really about
to. Yeah, you shouldn't. That's a big problem with Royal. Royal, you're like, I really wish you could have like import a Persona 5 save and just kind of like skip to the Royal
part. Fast forwarded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although there is stuff they added with the new girl in 5. I mean, she's
no. Yeah, I've heard.
Anyway,
that's all cute, but I doubt I'm redoing it. But either way, Persona 3 FES, the portable. No, not FES, excuse me.
No,
Persona
FES 3
portable.
Portable, which doesn't have the FES content.
Yeah.
Like, but it does have the Persona 4 style battle system where you can control your party members, which 3 did not have, when 3 FES doesn't have. So you actually. So, on a, like a quality of life way, you want to play. Not only does Persona 3 Portable have the female protagonist who is excellent, and that storyline is really cool that they do with her, it has like good quality of life improvements. Fez has the most true to the original intentions of Persona 3, and it has the sort of expansion, which is good.
Yeah, but the expansion is just more dungeon.
It's more dungeon, but the story is really good.
Yeah, but just it's worth knowing that the worst part of Persona 3 by a lot.
You play a lot more.
Is the dungeon. Tartarus
sucks. Yes. Tartarus does suck. Tartarus sucks.
Persona 4?
Some do the dungeons in Persona 4, but you can speed through them, so. Yeah.
In a way Persona 5 or Tartarus.
Yeah, Persona 5.
The dungeons, I think, are, like, I don't know if they're my favorite part of the game, but they are absurd.
Excellent. Cool. But I mean, like,
mind the puzzles, and I usually hate puzzles.
The puzzles are so easy, which I appreciate.
They're easy and they're fun, right? And like, they feel thematic. Everything is.
There's exactly one dungeon that is terrible.
Which one?
5. It's the second to last. Okay.
it's not the last boss one, and it's not the subsequent. So it's the it's the second to last one,
penultimate to penultimate,
penultimate. Right. It's not. So you just so you have you're doing the Makoto dungeon right now, right?
I just finished the bank.
Okay, it's the one. Oh no! So you don't have Futaba yet. So it's no. The one after Futaba.
Okay.
Futaba's is very good, both storyline and it's fun to play.
Yeah, I didn't so far, like. There's only one thing I don't like about. Well, there's I guess two things I don't like about the. I don't like the whatever the Mentos. Fuck is happening with the teacher.
Oh yeah, that's horrific. Don't yeah.
So I don't like that, and the other thing I don't like is. I mean, I appreciate that it's so big, but that is not to my taste. Although it is, like, in my head, I have... I don't know why we're doing this now. I'm so sorry. But in my head, Persona 5 is the exact opposite of Chrono Trigger. Like, as far as a JRPG goes. Like, Chrono Trigger is really old, but, like, has all these modern things in it, like... And, like, and is super short and is really tight and, like, hits every point and all the battles are on the screen. It's like a minimalist RPG. While Persona 5 is the most maximalist thing I've ever played. Where it's like, you can go anywhere and do anything and there's 10,000 things to do in every place you can go. And you can have like, you don't just get one quick side story, you get 18 side stories for every single character. And like, every dungeon has a million random battles that are super stylish and fancy. So like, to me, they're the opposite games. They're like the opposite ends of the JRPG spectrum.
It's fair. I just don't like Mementos.
It's weird. I think Mementos is fine. Like, I don't go to it often.
Yeah, I mean, you over time you have to go to it more, so.
Yeah, I've been there twice, I think, and I'm like on floor 4 or something, like 7. Each floor has its own like bunch of levels, right? So I'm on level 4 or so, it's fine.
I mean, you can really speed through it. More than any of the procedurally generated
dungeons. I have been. I really appreciate the, like, since I'm playing on the easier mode, that since I'm over, since that over-leveled me enough. That,
you can like, just, I like, smash just, through them?
Yeah, well, if I secret attack, it just smashes through.
That is with, very
it
nice.
It skips the battle. It's very nice. It's got that.
You don't get XP.
I don't give a shit. I, like, I'm already over-leveled, whatever.
Yes, it is one of the nicer things about it. All right. Let me talk real quick. Because I think we might talk a little bit longer about this other thing. Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers. I watched it yesterday. Yesterday?
You watched that, but you won't watch everything ever all at once. Go ahead.
I mean, Chip and Dale was great. It's worth it. It's
way better than it had any right to be. Like,
yeah, honestly, exactly.
Like, I had read that it was kind of like, you know, Zoomer who framed Roger Rabbit, and it basically was. But it was way better than I ever definitely could have thought. It was legitimately funny at moments, both like the side jokes they had and some of the jokes that they like were actually in the main story. The Lonely Island guys are very talented, so they did a good job. I don't need any sequels. I think it was good. I'm sure they'll come up with a sequel, but because it's Disney in 2022. But I really enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed the Mr. Doubtfire joke and Batman and versus ET. That joke was worth watching the movie entirely. Like, yeah. And Disney spent a lot of money on a movie that went straight to Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Like a lot. So.
Just interesting. It probably would have killed it in the theaters.
Yeah. Give some of that money to Obi-Wan. But anyway, the G word with Aaron's best friend, whose name escapes me, Adam something?
Adam Conover.
Conover, right. I watched that, finally, because I was like, I wanted to watch something that didn't, like, I don't know, I was in a mood on Friday after graduation, and I watched it.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. It was, I have complex feelings about it, just like I have complex feelings about Adam Ruins Everything. I think it was well presented, well researched, but very frustrating for most of the episodes. I think that one, you can really tell that Barack Obama was the executive producer of that show. Because the way, for those of you who haven't watched it, most of the episodes have a clear formula, which is Adam introduces a government concept, like something the government does. he talks about the good things the government does about it. Then Barack Obama gets him a sweet interview with somebody who's attached to it. And then he talks about a negative thing that the, that good part of the government does, and then has some sort of like wrapping up. Wouldn't it be great if our government functioned better thing? And what I increasingly found frustrating over the course of watching the first like six, there's like eight episodes, there's six, it might be the first three or four, was that he never really talked about the causes of a lot of these problems. Like he would just say there were problems, like they existed in the ether. Like if a lot of the first, say, three or four episodes were very like detached from any sort of historical context. It was just kind of like good thing government does, bad thing government does. But he never explained like why the bad things happened. Right. And the reason why a lot of these bad things happened is there is a movement called the conservative movement in the United States that actively tries to make our government not function. Mm-hmm. And since the 1980s, it has on and off controlled government. And they deeply reshape the way in which our government works for the worse. Now, he gets around to explaining this at the end of the show, the last two episodes, which are actually two of the strongest episodes of the show. But at the beginning, I would like get to this point. I'm like, oh, he's going to talk about Reagan now. He's going to talk about this. He's going to talk about Nixon. He's going to, and he just would be like, no, this isn't the government working. Time to go on to the next episode. In a way that I found very frustrating. To watch, which is a similar issue that I sometimes had with the Adam Ruins Everything episodes, where they like were good at describing things, but there's a moment where it's like you need to explain them, like what the origins of a lot of these bad things are.
I don't think that's the goal of the show, right? Like it's not saying how were things. It's saying here's how things are, or it's saying here's how things work. Here's what's wrong with them. It's not saying here's like,
but how may I put this? You can't identify how to change things if you can't point out what's causing them to be the way they are.
So I think the show's central premise is
he does at the end. Like again, he does say it at the end.
Sure, but I think the show's central premise of each episode, like what it's trying to do, is not until that last episode is trying to say that he doesn't think there are any solutions on the federal level. Like, he thinks that, like, it's building that frustration that, like, there aren't federal-level solutions. And, hey, I think he's probably right.
I mean,
like, Democrats have for my entire lifetime.
Yes.
Whenever they've had control, found excuses to not help. Right? Like, they don't tend to make things significantly worse, like Republicans do, but they don't make things better. Right? Better. So like, right, they're just like, we'll roll back a little bit of the more terrible shit and just continue with, like, status quo. Like, while conservatism as a problem that is destroying America is a relevant thing, obviously, I don't think that Congress is ever going to fix any of those issues.
I mean, and again, that's a perfectly valid point of view, but, like, it's not the show is not structured totally contemporaneously, right? Like, he consistently goes back to the New Deal and then traces sort of the evolution of this thing. But then the episodes are very structured, just like it's very, there's this big 70s and 80s sized gap in the stories he frequently tells, which is like in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, the government was kind of racist, sometimes extremely racist, but it was at least trying to do good things. What, not necessarily perfectly, but was trying to make things better. Then it stops doing that and does this other thing that it's currently doing that's really bad.
There's there's a point where he just shit talks Ayn Rand, isn't there?
That not Ayn Rand, but there's a point where he basically tells the standard historical narrative. It's in the second, not the episode with Philly and Obama, which is the very last one, the fifth episode, where he goes, it's conservatism. Let me tell you the story. It's like New Deal good, conservative buildup. It's literally what I'm teaching my students right now. So I'm like all about it. Conservative buildup over the course of the 60s and 70s explodes in the Reagan administration. Reagan administration really damages government, its ability to help people. Clinton
Right. It's the
Colbert episode. That, and then Obama, he does call out Obama in that episode. Mm-hmm. So, which I did appreciate it. I thought it was very brave, actually, all things considered. But I enjoyed the show. I just didn't like a lot of the apparatus. And I do think, and I mean this really seriously, that the episode that he did on money, I thought the sequence he did about the FDIC was really cool, but the way he explained how bailouts work was actively unhelpful for how people can understand and think about the ways in which monetary policy impacts them. I was actually legitimately yelling at the television, both when I literally said when Penn and Teller showed up, spoilers, I'm sorry, showed up. I was like, no, Penn and Teller, no Penn and Teller. Two, I don't think he does a very good job of explaining how monetary policy works and like how it negatively impacts people. And I was actually like legitimately disappointed in him because he did a good job.
Super like the food episode. I love the weather episode here. I'm trying to open to see what the episodes are because it's been a month now. Give me the episode lit.
It's weather, money, healthcare.
I really like healthcare. I really, really like weather. Weather, I surprisingly weather was I like cool. Tech.
Tech was
I didn't
good.
Love tech, but I like tech. Yeah, tech I knew, and like part of the reason, like I thought the food episode was good, but there was nothing in the food episode I didn't know, right? I thought that it's helpful for people to know the tech episode because I don't feel like people do. I had no idea any of the weather stuff, like at all.
I knew vaguely the weather stuff, but it was good to get more like details. Money, I knew the basic contours. The money episode was legit. I legitimately think it undermined his own point.
Yeah.
Like, I think he just did such a poor job explaining monetary policy. And what was super upsetting is I think people in the political crisis we're currently in, I think people thinking wisely about monetary policy is really like important. This is because I've been literally talking with my students about monetary policy this week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the current economic situation with inflation, like, we have to think really carefully about it and what our goals are and what's the best way to get out of the situation we're in. So we don't repeat some of the like ways in which the Federal Reserve solved our last time we had strong inflation in this country, which was to create a recession through deflation that really damaged the long-term abilities of working class people to earn livings.
Do you think that's not where we're headed?
I hope we're not. I hope that's not where we're heading.
Of course, that's where we're
heading. But look, but that's why I'm saying people need to think thoughtfully about it. And I don't think Adam did a very good job of helping his audience like navigate these things.
That's very fair. I don't.
Where he did, I think, with like.
Think that thinking thoughtfully about it will help. I don't think that there's. Like, I genuinely, like, am utterly out of hope for our federal government. I think that, like, if they can make things worse, they will.
Well, I feel you, Aaron, but I think what's important for like everyday people, and this is something I was like talking with my students and we were having really interesting conversations about this, right? Is like the problem with monetary policy, right? Is things that you intuitively might think are good, like deflation, right? Mm-hmm. Would be good, but it's not, right? And in fact, actually deflation is worse for everyday people like the three of us, or even people who are poorer than us. And that's like this counterintuitive thing that my students, when they talk and we learn about like what happened in deflation in the 80s, they're like kind of like, whoa, I don't like inflation that's happening here right now. But if deflation is not the solution, then what is the solution to problems that we have today? And kids had interesting things to say about that. And that's what people need to be thinking about, right? Not like the way he explains these similar problems that we're starting to have today with these, like the metaphors he uses, and just, it's just really just not helpful. And I'm really dogging on this episode because it really did stand out among the other ones, as I think all of them were otherwise very articulate and like done with a lot of care with some complex issues. Like I think the tech one was done with care, particularly the way he talked about drones, I think was,
yeah.
And his willingness to call out the drone war, which again, his sponsor, Barack Obama, was partially responsible for, you know,
escalating. And escalating. Largely responsible for
escalating. Well, I mean, Bush, but Obama did literally run in 2008 saying, I won't invade any more countries, I'll bomb them with drones.
Escalating, right? Like, escalating.
There you go.
Bush started using it, Obama escalated the shit out of it.
So,
yeah, I mean, anyway. I really, really, really like 4 of the 6 episodes, and 3 of the 4 I really like taught me new things that I thought were very interesting.
A lot of them were really interesting, and the interviews were really good. Yeah. He's a good interviewer, actually.
Mm-hmm. His podcast is excellent. He's got a podcast called Factually, where he just interviews experts.
He's a very good interviewer, and his like energy was very like very authentic in a way that was like during the interviews and like the sequences that was very endearing. So even when I was frustrated with it, I was
apparently willing to... this was based on a Michael Lewis book, which I did not realize until the end.
Did say that, but I wonder. I'm assuming him and Obama are going to do another show at some point.
I don't know. There's a podcast. I clicked open the podcast. A few episodes back is the G Word and the Truth About Our Government with Michael Lewis. So apparently he interviews Michael Lewis. I should listen to that at some point.
Yep. Well, sorry to have put Will to sleep while we were...
That's okay. I mean, these are interesting topics. I just haven't watched that particular show. So
I definitely think it would be... It's worth watching with a skeptical eye, which is kind of how I felt towards... Adam Ruins Everything, although I found it kind of exhausting, as Aaron and I have talked about before. So.
All right. Is there anything else, or is that it?
I think that's everything.
I think that's it. Yeah. Look at us.
Hey, watch the G-Room. You will learn at least something.
You will definitely learn things.
There you go.
Been learning
weather.
Between
the Who knew?
All right. I guess that puts us in the danger zone?